Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And it's my honor to welcome to the program today retired United States Navy Admiral Jim Stavridis, NATO's former Supreme Allied Commander and a former Dean of the Fletcher School, who is now an operating executive with the Carlyle Group Merchant Bank, as well as the chairman of the Board of Counselors at McLarty Associates. He's also NBC News' chief international analyst. He is a talented and prolific writer. His latest book with author and former Marine Elliot Ackerman is 2034, a novel of the next world war. Sir, it's always an honor and pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. We've had many good interviews over the years.
Indeed, we have, sir. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. You're channeling your inner Tom Clancy here a little bit, and I don't want to give away the plot. There are a lot of great characters, whether Sarah Hunt, Wedge Mitchell, Sandy Chowdhury, Lynn Bow, or the three-fingered Farshad. Elements of this book are really gut-wrenching, as only a novel that delivers hard truths does. Why a novel format, and why 2034? Because a lot of people would say or think that by 2034, we should be over bad relations with China, right? Beijing will have weakened for internal reasons. Why a novel format? Why that date?
The novel format is easy to answer because it gets a much wider audience as opposed to writing yet another policy paper about U.S.-China relations. It's a story, and people like stories. Number two, you alluded to it, you can bring characters into a novel, and therefore you can illuminate the American people, the Iranian people, the Chinese, through these interesting characters. And then third and finally, you can imagine more freely. You can sort of think to yourself, well, what would happen if in a novel format? I think much more freely than you can when you bind yourself in a very factual way. So that's really why the novel. And I'm very happy with the outcome. And it is gut-wrenching. And the idea of the book is to be a cautionary tale, to try and show to a large U.S. audience, but I think also to a Chinese audience. I'm very hopeful this book will be reasonably well received in China. There's not good guys and bad guys here. There's a villain, and the villain is war. And it's a story of miscalculation, a story of two nations that sleepwalk themselves into a war that does have some devastating consequences. I don't want to give away the book either, but I will say it's not apocalyptic. It's not the end of the world, but there are many tough moments for all the characters in 2034.
And why that date?
We started, and this may be part of your question in a certain sense, we started with the idea of writing about much later in the century, 2084, for example. And the more we thought and wrote about the characters and what they were doing, the more it felt as though, you know, this situation, this sense of real tension between the United States and China, I think is going to come to a head in about 15 years. And I'll tell you why. That's where the technology will have matured in cyber and quantum computing and hypersonics and space satellite systems and unmanned vehicles, the new Marine Corps concepts. All of that, I think, will mature right around the 15-year point on both sides. So both sides will have a pretty full kit bag, if you will, of technology. And then secondly, if you look at the disagreements we have with China, they're not going to go away. Ownership of the South China Sea, conflict in cyberspace, trade and tariff disagreements, all of these very much, if you look at trend lines, probably will be relatively benign, I would say, in the immediate term, say in the 3 to 5 year future. But beyond that term, I think the forces of nationalism in both countries combined with that uptick in the technology makes, you know, the middle part of the next decade, around 2034, 2035, a moment of real danger.
You've hit on some very powerful themes in the book, from national hubris, for example. H.R. McMaster rightly points out, right? I mean, we have an American strategic narcissism, that a nation that's lost its sense of self and imagination. You talk about that, you know, blinding the elephant, if you will, through cyber means. And the challenges with technology, what are the takeaways, right? What are the takeaways you want, you know, it's from the broad geostrategics, but what are some of the other elements you want the audience to think about?
Number one is geopolitical, and it is the rise of India. India is coming as a great power. And the more the United States can work with India, the better this century will be for the United States of America. So number one, the rise of India. Number two, the critical importance of cyber, especially as quantum computing comes online toward the end of this decade, a potential huge game changer in really every element of warfare. I'd say number three would be the rise of Iran and Iran's ability to partner with China going forward. And that has already begun in a variety of scenarios, particularly economic. And then fourth and finally, use the word hubris. We need to recognize that China will rise. The question is, how do we avoid sleepwalking into a significant conflict with them? And it will probably occur in the South China Sea and spool out from a maritime event of some kind. So I think those are the big themes of the work.
Graham Allison of Harvard wrote The Thucydides Trap a couple of years ago, warning that, you know, historically these kind of relationships do have a tendency of ending up in war unless you're actively planning to avoid it. What are some of the things that we need to be doing now, right? We've heard warnings from the Indo-Pacific commander, Phil Davidson, who's in town, was in town last week to talk about his strategy and what we need to do to deter China, because his concern is that we have less than a decade before there could be that China would want to move on Taiwan. What are the things that we need to be doing now from your standpoint?
Yeah, the first thing we need is a strategy. We've taken an extremely tactical, episodic approach to China over the last 4 years, the 4 years of the Trump administration. And we have never sat down and constructed a coherent strategy that brings all the tools of U.S. power together. So as you point out, Phil Davidson was in town and spoke, I thought, compellingly about the need for better technology, more military capability, more warships, because a lot of this will be maritime based. I thought he laid out a very good case, but a narrow case. He was, as is his job, talking about the military element. But what we're lacking is, okay, what are the diplomatic moves we should make that we put alongside that? I would argue this would include strengthening our relationships with Japan, convincing the Europeans, particularly NATO and the European Union, to come and operate with us in the Pacific. I think it will include, above all, working closely with India, developing this idea, which is sometimes called the Quad of Japan, Australia, US, India, conducting more operations in the Indian Ocean diplomatically. So there's a diplomatic component that has to go alongside the military one that Admiral Davidson was talking about. Thirdly, it's the economics. We need to recognize the power of our markets here in the United States. And this was something the Trump administration, I thought, was correct in doing, which is metering China's access to our markets in response for or in question with China's decisions about fair trade, about letting U.S. companies come into China, about not stealing intellectual property. So there's a significant economic component that goes alongside the other two. Thirdly, there's a tech component. How do our high-end technology companies figure into this equation? How do we prevent Huawei from taking over the 5G networks around the world? So a tech component. And then fifth and finally, there's a what I'll call a cultural communications kind of component here that involves using our cultural proclivities, our film industry, our exchanges from university to university, our Chinese-American community. My son-in-law is Chinese-American. He's first generation, born here. He knows and understands China, has deep relatives in China. These are all different tools that we need to put together in a coherent strategy that recognizes China is rising. And as Graham Allison says, the Thucydides trap is kind of the looming tower, meaning so often in world history, when an established power, in this case, the United States, is challenged by a rising power, in this case, China, so often in human history, going back 2,500 years to the era of Thucydides, the Greek historian, Athens and Sparta in those days, so often those two nations go to war, more often than not, kind of two-thirds of the time. So we've got to avoid that. The best way to avoid it is a coherent strategy, as I've outlined.
It's also great that you have Aristimus in there as well, right? I mean, so you've got some of the classical elements nailed down, sir. You warn about an overdependence on technology as well, and it's apt, right? You attended the United States Naval Academy, proud class of 1976, and celestial navigation was the bane and terror of every first class midshipman. You know, but we did away with that for 2 years, just to use, you know, and thankfully it's back again on the curriculum. But your concerns kind of go far deeper. What's the right balance between too much and too little technology, right? What's the right futurist Luddite balance that we need to strike?
This is a great question. And you're right to surface navigation. And when I went into the fleet in the 70s, of course, we used sextants and navigational tables and took sightings of the stars and the sun and the moon and calculated our position. We didn't use any electronics. Over time, we came to rely more and more and more on GPS, on satellite solutions, to the point where Navy ships actually stopped using paper charts for a time. We're starting to realize that that is an untenable position. And I actually wrote about this over 20 years ago. You'll remember the Revolution in Military Affairs. Right? This was right. Vice Admiral Art Sabrowski and a vision that we were going to put everything together. C2 was going to combine into one seamless network. And it, you know, it's kind of happened, but it brings vulnerabilities with it. And so I think to answer your question, where do we find the balance? I think you need both. So you need the high tech world, but you better have a plan B. And I would say that this will involve, if you will, I'm making up a word here, primitivizing. In other words, creating systems that can be put in a mode where they're not connected to the internet, where they're not dependent on electronics. And standalone systems in cyber, for example, I think potentially could be very critical. Having part of your network and your systems that are simply not connected to the
air-gapped, effectively, air-gapped.
Exactly, air-gapped, good word. So the short answer to the question is we got to find a balance. I think we'll be 85% high-tech, but I think you need, you know, kind of 15% in your back pocket where you understand that you can operate in a plan B environment.
There is a tendency of thinking about China as alone, right, and without allies, that we're the ones that have all the allies and partnerships around the world. And we like to sort of reassure ourselves that we've sort of got a bead on this situation. Your book starkly gives lie to that theory. What do we have to bear in mind, not just about our allies, but China's allies?
Yeah, I think the obvious one is Russia. And if you think about the two nations, there are a lot of similarities and some differences that allow them to, in the Jerry Maguire words, complete each other. So they're both ancient civilizations. They're both long, always authoritarian states. They're both extremely prideful of that history. They're both highly nationalistic. They have both controlled empires at one time or another. They're both nuclear armed, and they share a very long border. Those are all kind of similarities. The big difference is that China has a huge population and very few natural resources. Russia has a small population in relative terms. It's about 140 million and going down, but they have lots of natural resources. So think of Siberia. It's this vast land area the size of the United States, the continental United States of America. It's full of oil, natural gas, timber, arable land, fresh water, rare earths. It is a treasure trove, and nobody lives there. Maybe 20 million people live there in an area the size of the continental United States. So take the 20 million people who live in New York, but spread them out over the whole country. So it's highly depopulated. China looks at that the way my dog looks at a ribeye steak. It looks really good. And so those two nations are drawing closer and closer together, and they have a shared interest in opposition to the United States and in maintaining authoritarian norms around the world. So that's one significant, not yet a formal treaty ally, but drawing closer and closer. And then the other one that we illuminate in 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, is China and Iran. And I think that's another fairly natural pairing, particularly because China is very concerned about India, and Iran is geographically positioned to be a bit of a counter to India. This is why China is also quite close with Pakistan. So look for China to develop those geopolitical pairings. They may blossom into full-blown alliances. And you're absolutely right. We have a significant network of allies, partners, and friends, but China is working to develop one as well, particularly using the so-called One Belt, One Road strategy.
It's not lost on anybody that the systems in the book are the systems that we have today by and large, right? DDG 51s, I would point out, you were the Planck owning commanding officer, the second Burke-class destroyer, the USS Barry. Is the Navy and the wider force building the kind of capabilities that we need so that in a decade's time, we can continue to deter China?
I think we need to do a better job of building several particular kinds of capabilities. One is cyber, with an eye in particular toward discovering how quantum computing will change that. So cyber. Number two is we need to be better at unmanned vehicles, broadly speaking, from space down to the bottoms of the oceans. More and more platforms will be capable of operating in autonomous ways because of, you know, see paragraph one about cyber, artificial intelligence, machine learning, all driven by quantum computing. So cyber, unmanned. And thirdly, this one may or may not surprise you, I think on the people side of the equation, we will look more and more at special forces, what we think of today as special forces, but more in the idea of creating elite warriors who deeply specialize in cyber, in space, in strategy, in what we think of today as direct action on the part of SEALs and Rangers and Green Berets. I think that there'll be less emphasis on large standing troop formations, because it's just so unlikely to me that we'd end up in a massive Cold War style fight that involves divisions and armies. I think instead, elite forces are going to become more the norm. So I think of that as a kind of a new strategic triad, cyber, unmanned, and special forces. And yeah, I'm an admiral, so I'm going to tell you we need a bigger Navy because we've got global commitments, and China, I think, can already overmatch us ship for ship, plane for plane in the South China Sea. Therefore, they're not deterred by us to the degree we would want them to be. So I think we've got to increase our maritime capability along the way. And long-range air will be important as well. There's some ideas.
Let me take you to a cultural question, right? And one of the characters, and I absolutely, there's a couple of really terrific quotes in here, right? What the Americans lacked or lost along the way was imagination. That was a really good one. But the one that really, really was the sledgehammer between the eyes was, the America that we believe ourselves to be is no longer the America that we are. And there are folks who are looking at the aftermath of the pandemic, more than 500,000 dead. This was the nation that put man on the moon and could do impossible things. We heard from Adam Smith, the chairman, the cerebral chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, sort of point out to the world that the most important deterrent capability the United States has is this can-do-ness about America, right? Throughout history, America was the country that could get big things done. And now we can't even govern ourselves. We can't fight a pandemic. What are the broader cultural changes, sir, that have to happen from leadership all the way down to the deck plates to get that sort of the mojo back effectively? Because it seems as though we satisfy ourselves with ticking off boxes, and people who are too brash or too cerebral or too whatever sort of tend to get weeded out by the system, right? What are the broad cultural things that we have to do as a nation to get that chi back, not to mix metaphors, given where it is we're going?
Well, first of all, you're right to point out in the novel 2034, this is part of the cautionary tale, is hubris on the part of the United States of America. And who are we? My own assessment is this. I am not a triumphalist who believes the United States should be the world's policeman and direct every global assembly. But I do think I am not a defeatist. I don't think our best days are behind us. And part of the reason for that is we still have a pretty strong hand of cards. We're an enormous geographic entity, rich in natural resources. We have a young population. Our demographics are good. People want to come here. People desperately want to come to the United States of America. Silicon Valley, highly innovative. Our millennial generation, I've fought with them in Afghanistan and Iraq, are brave and courageous and care about this nation deeply. Our universities are the envy of the world still. We have a pretty good hand of cards. In fact, I don't think any other nation on this earth, given the choice, would fail to say, yep, I'll trade places. I think we are still very capable. Now, what's our problem? Our problem is, and we saw it, I think, most richly on display on the 6th of January, is that we are a deeply divided, polarized country, and that extremes on both left and right are dominating our political discourse and pulling us apart. So I think our primary mission as a nation, because we have all the resources, we have all the people, we have an enviable geographic position in the world, I think our primary mission is to find again how we can coherently work together. And we don't have time on this podcast to go through all of the reasons and ways that we could do that, but I'll give you three quick ideas as we wrap up. One is we should work very hard to celebrate the idea of service. And here I don't mean simply saying to military people or veterans, thank you for your service. I mean, understanding that there are so many ways to serve this country, certainly our military, but how about our police, our firemen, our diplomats, our CIA officers? How about Peace Corps volunteers? What about school teachers in rural Virginia teaching a packed classroom under COVID conditions for $37,000 a year? You think she's serving the country? I do. How about medical personnel, doctors, nurses, EMTs facing this pandemic? How about journalists? You know, when I would go to Afghanistan in my heavy body armor and my security guards around me, standing next to me would be my current NBC colleague, Richard Engel, you know, armed with an iPhone and a ill-fitting bulletproof vest. Journalists work hard to tell us the truth about the world. Are they serving the country? I think so. So my point is, collectively we should be celebrating those ideas of service, because service is bipartisan, service is nonpartisan. Secondly, education. We need to put more resources into education, kind of at every level. But a particular tactical thing we need to do is to educate the population about how to use the internet, how to discern what is patently false, what is probably false, what is deliberate misinformation, what is rumor mongering. There are real techniques, tactics, and procedures to do that. We put a smartphone in the hand of a child when he or she is 11 and a half years old, but we don't tell them how to understand what they're looking at in that stream of information that flows over them. So education, I think, is quite critical, with a particular emphasis on understanding how to interact with the internet. And third and finally, and this is political, and I'm going to preface it by saying, and you know this, I'm a registered independent. I've never been a Republican. I've never been a Democrat. I'm a registered independent, and I'm a centrist. I was vetted for vice president by Hillary Clinton. I was offered a cabinet post by the Trump administration. I kind of think of that as two bullets whizzing by my head. But the point is, we need to look for candidates who are willing to be in the center, who are willing to reach across the aisles. I spent 5 years in Massachusetts, the most liberal state in the country. Yet they have a Republican governor, a guy named Charlie Baker. He routinely builds coalitions, reaches across aisles. My congressman, young guy named Seth Moulton, a veteran, has a significant combat record, and somebody who he's a Democrat, but he's very willing to reach across the aisles and work with someone like Adam Kinzinger, a Republican on the other side. So I would say, as voters, regardless of whether we are card-carrying Fox News people, or we wake up in the morning watching MSNBC, wherever you are on the political spectrum, you have a vested interest in electing officials who are willing to reach across aisles and work with others. There's three quick ideas. We could talk a lot more about all of this. I want to close by saying I'm optimistic about the United States of America. We've had our differences in the past. As recently as the 1960s, we were as polarized as we are now. We had a civil war that almost destroyed the country 150 years ago. We'll get through this, just like we're going to get through the pandemic. Our best days are not behind us. They're ahead of us.
Sir, if I may, very, very briefly, though, what's the window, right? How long do we have to do the things that we need to do to move those needles, right? I mean, there are all kinds of programmatic questions, whether about littoral combat ship, DDG 1000, or the Ford class carriers, which play a prominent role in the book. What's the window we have to start to get all of this right, to make the changes we have to make as a nation, right? I mean, civil infrastructure, you talked about that. I mean, there are huge weaknesses as solar winds and the hafnium attacks have shown. What's the window in your mind? Is it a 5-year window, a 10-year window, a 2-year window?
I think we still have a pretty good stretch of runway ahead of us where we can work on all the things we've talked about, improving our technologies, improving our national psychology, if you will, finding more unification in the nation, including working on climate, which I think is an extremely important issue for the nation. I think we've got a kind of 5 to 7 year window to work on these things before our principal competitor, which of course is China, decides that they are starting to pull away from us. We don't want to be in that position because at that stage, I think our ability to deter China from taking actions that would be red lines for us begins to significantly erode. So short answer is, we've still got time on the clock. We better use it well. I'm going to have to leave it there. It's been wonderful talking to you. I thought it was a great conversation.
Sir, thanks.
Thank you.
Sir, thanks very much. Always an honor and a pleasure. You're welcome on anytime. Thank you so much.
We'll do it again. Bye-bye.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.